Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insider's Capital. Markets don't move in straight lines, but they do move in patterns. And if you pay close enough attention, those patterns can tell you a lot about where we are, where we've been, and what's likely coming next. In April, the dominant story was a market caught between war headlines and fragile hope, a sawtooth tape grinding through Middle East uncertainty, supply chain warnings, and a market that hadn't yet decided whether to believe in the peace rally. By May, the picture had completely transformed. The S&P 500 had rocketed to all-time highs, semiconductors were in full melt-up, and FOMO had effectively replaced fundamentals as the dominant market force. 1 month, completely different tape. And yet, if you know how to read the seasonal calendar, none of it was entirely surprising. Brooke Thackeray is a research analyst with Global X Investments Canada and the author of the Thackeray Newsletter, a monthly seasonality-driven market letter he's been publishing for two decades. He's also the prolific author of the Quintessential Annual Guides to Seasonal Investing, Thackeray's Investor's Guides. He tracks when sectors tend to rise and fall and why. And right now, the seasonal clock is ticking into some of the most treacherous months of the year, even as the market keeps defying gravity.
This is Insider's Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Brooke, it is terrific to have you back on the show.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. And here we are on the eve of the first trade of SpaceX, Friday, June 12th, 2026. What's been made out to be sort of the financial markets event of the year, until, of course, something else comes along. But this is a pretty big deal, Brooke, right? I mean, it's been quite a year, and it feels like a lot of the excitement is being driven by what's going on, first of all, in AI, which is the dominant market theme, the key driver of markets this year. And that seems to have overridden everything. And then we've got a slew of gigantic IPOs, behemoths, starting with the SpaceX IPO today, but soon to be followed by Anthropic and OpenAI later this year. First of all, what are your thoughts on this year? I mean, it's been quite a year so far.
Yeah, it's been a little bit crazy because we did see that big correction take place. And then in April, we saw the market rally strongly in the middle of a war, really, is what took place. And it was, there's a lot of animal spirits going here, and there's a lot of FOMO driving this. And the rally took the market from being oversold to overbought really quickly. And we're seeing the market continue to melt up here. And this is a lot of the FOMO that's taking place with investors. They want to be there. They don't want to miss out on the rally. And, it's hard to blame them when you see the market moving up like this and ignoring really any bad news along the way, saying, well, it doesn't really matter. The market's moving. That's all that matters. I'm going to be there. And that's what we're seeing. And so we're seeing a variety of drivers pushing the market higher. A lot of it's coming from retail investors. We're seeing gamma squeeze going higher. So retail investors are buying call options out of the money on the markets. And, as the market moves up, that's forcing market makers to go in and buy the underlying securities to hedge their positions. And just like what they did with GameStop, and it's happening in the broader market as well. We're seeing a market that the animal spirits have taken over, and they're not really that concerned about things like, do we have enough oil? Or do we have enough helium or all these other products right now? Well, it could be impacted.
Yeah, and those were the items. Those were some of the items that you flagged in your April newsletter. Year on year, what I thought was funny was year on year, we had the anniversary of Liberation Day coincide with the anniversary of the announcement of the Strait of Hormuz being opened up or reopened. And the end of that week, the S&P 500 was back to an all-time high. From a seasonality standpoint, what happened? And did the seasonal patterns give you any early signal that the tape was about to change that dramatically?
So we are actually in the strong seasonal period for the markets in April. at the time. So we saw the market correct. And when the market's in a strong seasonal period, it can be a little bit risky to go against it because the market tends to perform well. And April tends to be one of the better months of the year for the stock market. And it once again was one of the better months of the year. It was set up well with an oversold condition as well. So it was primed. It had the fertile ground to provide the backdrop for the market to move higher here on that. And you're right. You know, actually, I was talking about some of the shortages that could develop in the future back quite a bit, actually, with the helium shortage. We all know about oil and natural gas and infrastructure, and currently there's 1.5 billion barrels of oil that's being lost due to this whole Middle East confrontation or war.
Yep.
But, you know, there's also things like, helium. And it's not really being talked about very much in the news. And you need helium to actually make semiconductor chips because it's an integral right. part of that. And it's not the only one, by the way. It's also, you need tungsten hexafluoride. And last night, actually, very timely, you saw Samsur, a commodity data firm in Japan, announced that Japan is saying there's going to be a 25% reduction in the amount of tungsten fluoride that yeah. is going to be exported. And it's a huge problem for the semiconductors because you also need that as well. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a depletion of inventories for all of these things, and it's not really being factored in here. Nobody at this time is saying, hey, you know what? This is a big, big concern. We may not be able to make semiconductor chips in the not so distant yep. future, out of a few months, if the war continues. And I think it's a belief that the war is not, it's going to be solved here and we're going to get back on track and everybody's going to flick a switch and it's going to happen. But that may not be the case. And so that there's definitely risk in that. And it's not just that, it's fertilizer. The list goes on and on about these things that are just really structuring the commodity complex here at this point and providing some imbalances.
Typically, May is viewed as, you know, the sell in May and go away month in seasonality. How would you describe the May rally and sort of how that is contrary to the standard sell in May adage?
Okay, so seasonality here really is about probabilities of events taking place and stacking the probabilities on your side. It doesn't mean it always happens. And when we have strong exogenous factors taking place, which is what we have now with investor narrative pumping the markets higher. And, you know, that can overcome that in the short term. But still the backdrop tends to give some context about what could take place in the weaker months of the year. The seasonal trends are still there. In the short term, we can see some influence from other trends taking place. And that's what we're seeing right now, SpaceX IPO, you know, it looks yeah. like it's going to be 30% up on the first at the opening or whatever it is at this point and trying to still line up the orders. So there's a lot of like, I want to be there in the market. And those are the animal spirits. And that overcomes fundamentals too, because it's just, I don't want to go too much into SpaceX IPO, but, you know, at the price of $135, they're looking at 92 times sales, which is for a company that doesn't make any money is huge. But if we're taking the, you know, 30% higher, really we're at 120 times sales. And there's just still a lot of excitement around it. And these type of fundamentals don't really care about seasonality, about fundamentals. You know, everything yeah. sort of goes out the window, at least in the short term. Sometimes it catches up with it. You know, we could see, you know, pull back down the road once we get past the launch or something like that. That's totally possible. But whether you get a weak non-farm payroll number or interest rates might move a little bit higher, when you're already paying 92 times or 120 times sales, really, does it really matter? And that's the rationale for investors at this point. So what I'm trying to say is when you see the market like this with this excitement around the narrative, and it overcomes a lot. And so in the short term, we can see seasonality be overcome, just like any other discipline, whether it's fundamentals or technicals as well. But be careful with that because, you know, for instance, we do see weaker months of the year for the markets coming up, August and September, which are the two weakest months of the year. Maybe once we get past that earnings season and all the IPOs are out of the way, we could see the narrative shift once again. And it's more likely to do that from a seasonal context in the weaker months of the year, so August and September. So if we're seeing the markets run here, I'd be quite concerned, and I would call that, you know, like the dead zone that you really have to watch out for the markets, because it tends to be when the big drops in the market occur, that's when they tend to occur. Not all the time, but on average over the long period of time, you've been rewarded for respecting that. So that could happen once again.
And it's not so much, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, 10 stocks have been leading the market, have been providing most of the return in markets recently, 10 stocks. So if you look past those 10 names at the remaining, like if you're looking at the S&P 500 and you look at the remaining 490 or so names, a lot of the, like there's some increase in breadth in the market, but a lot of the activity that's going on in the other 490 names, seasonality still largely applies to them.
Yeah, it does actually. I mean,
but it's being overshadowed, right?
Totally overshadowed with this. You know, let's be into tech, and I track what's taking place between the sectors of the market. I break the market down into three camps, basically, or segments. One is the growth sectors of the market, and they can be very different. You know, so you're looking at, technology, obviously, consumer discretionary, and telecommunications. And I'll take a look at the cyclical sectors. So, you know, we're taking a look at energy, industrials, materials, and financials. And then we're taking a look at the defensives, which would be healthcare, utilities, and consumer staples. And, you know, the real estate really is a little bit between the cyclical and the defensive. So I track these and take a look at what's happening in the market. We've seen this really in this strong rally, just an overwhelming movement. And it's interesting, not even just the growth. So it's usually you find the growth sectors all do well together, like the consumer discretionary and telecommunications goes up with the technology sector. But that's not what's happening here. Mm-hmm. It's technology. That's it.
Yeah,
and we're seeing the other parts of the market not do so well. As you mentioned, 490 stocks. And that's a concern because the market's become extremely narrow. And what I try and track too is, well, where's the money flowing? Where's it going? And, you know, we've seen, you know, in downturns, the money still goes into some of the defensive sectors when we see the market pull back, even in this bigger cycle, this, you know, over the last couple of months, it's still going through the defensives here a little bit. My concern will be if the money leaves technology and it doesn't, it just leaves the market. And that will be the concern that, so I try and track those money flows to give an indication of what's happening. If we see money flowing into the defensives, that means investors still want to be invested at this time. And, you know, they're not leaving the market overall. And so that means the market can go on pause and then go back and watch the money flow back into the technology sector, perhaps. And that's exactly what's happened, by the way. You know, we saw that take place with the money flow into March, we saw the money start to flow more into the defensives. And then, you know, in April, it went right back into the technology sector. But so I'm looking for that overall money flow to see if it's leaving the market, which would indicate that the market's actually turning down.
Yeah. And that leads to a new question. I mean, historically, Brooke, when you see that kind of narrow leadership driving an index to new highs, what does seasonality tell us about the durability of those moves? Is this the kind of breadth profile that tends to resolve well, or does history suggest that we should be paying attention to what isn't participating?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to be taking a look at what's not participating in that rally to give us some signals here overall. And it's just technology. And if the U.S. economy is doing so well, we'd expect to see the industrials performing well, and the materials sector, and the other sectors really doing well here, not just technology. So this is showing a very narrow market, and we can take a look at a number of market breadth analysis. There's no question this is a narrow market, and what that means is the market's really fragile. We're seeing fragility build up in the market. It doesn't indicate, you can't really say, hey, this is when we're going to see a correction take place or a pullback take place. It's not really possible in this type of a situation. I've done lots of studies on this. It can just keep going in a melt up and just surprise everybody. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing a melt up take place. And, you know, it's, but there's some catalyst that comes along And usually it's out of the ordinary that people aren't expecting. And, you know, let's go back and take a look at, you know, the before the tech wreck. And I'm not saying we're in a tech bubble here, and I'm not saying the market's about to go through this multi-year pullback like we saw with the tech wreck.
Yeah.
Back in 1999, 2000. I'm talking about flows of money. If we go back to the late 1990s, you know, we had, what was performing well? Technology. What wasn't performing well? Really, on a relative basis, everything else.
Right.
So it's really similar right now. Resources, commodities, nobody wanted oil. Nobody wanted potash. Nobody wanted copper. I mean, these, you know, I remember Trimark came out with a fund in 1998, 1999. And it was basically called, yeah, we invest in anything but commodities. I mean, that's really what it was.
Right.
And it was, then we saw that flip when the market did correct. And, you know, on the other side of the mountain, going down to 2001, 2002, investors went, what? We're short potash? We're short uranium? Yeah. How come nobody told us? Yeah, we told, you know, everybody knew, but nobody cared. And then we saw that multi-year commodity cycle, super cycle take place from 2002 to 2007, and all the commodities went up. I actually think we could be setting up for that again, where we are in a very similar situation. And because what's happening is AI and these super behemoth IPOs are sucking the oxygen and liquidity away from the other parts of the market. And so, you know, we're seeing even things like gold actually go down here quite a bit, leading into the SpaceX IPO. And a lot of people are postulating, well, maybe that's investors selling out, the tourists, as we say, that are in there for the hot money, selling out, yeah, so they can fund their IPO for, you know, once SpaceX comes on, they can do that. So we're seeing that again, very similar phenomena, very similar money flow, but that could change. And if you want to know when the market's going to get in trouble, it's really only, you have to follow the technology sector. I think the market's okay from a health perspective until the technology sector tends to roll over.
It's interesting. I think, you know, when you consider, you know, you said something interesting just now, and, you know, you said a lot of interesting things, but I want to pull on the thread of, you know, that technology is sucking all of the oxygen and the money out of the market. And it's not only that, right? I mean, technology, the AI is also going to suck water. It's going to suck electricity. I mean, I recently read an academic paper from MIT, which was published last year, but it pointed to the amount of energy that's required to run simple prompt, to code. And then the big one was the big sort of singular item that it highlighted in this MIT paper was that to create 8 seconds of video took the same amount of electricity as running a microwave for 1 hour.
Yeah, crazy, eh?
Right? That's astonishing. It's like the amount of water it takes to grow one avocado, right? It takes something like between 150 to 200 liters of water to grow one avocado, right? And people don't realize that this is what's coming down the road. You know, there's a lot of talk of Jevons paradox. There's a lot of talk about, you know, how AI is going to take away a lot of jobs. It could actually lead to the contrary. It could actually create a lot of jobs, a lot more productivity, a lot more growth than people realize. But it's also going to require a ton of electricity. So underneath all of that is that some sectors like utilities have become rather exciting again, right? And maybe while the market is so focused, so deadlocked on these 10, let's say 10 to 15 names, if we want to even widen it that far, there's opportunities, obviously, in those old world, old school sectors that are coming that are rather exciting. Like in uranium has shown really signs of strength this past year because of the resurgence of interest in nuclear. But that's just one example of where the obvious example of where something like commodities suddenly become, you know, exciting again. And to your point, and utilities suddenly are becoming exciting again. And you introduced in May the idea of war fatigue, and that investors have basically tuned out the whole Middle East conflict and assume that, you know, they're discounting a resolution. They're assuming that that's all going to work out. And seasonality, a big part of seasonality is about psychology repeating itself. What kind of thing do you think is possibly going to make people recalibrate or revisit the whole opportunity there, if you're looking at the psychology of it?
Yeah. Okay. So I was back in the business back in the 1990s and 2000s. And, you know, I remember all the narrative that was taking place. And I think absolutely. And the world's going to be changed by AI. And the world was changed by the internet, implementation of the internet as well, when it became mass, into the mass market. I mean, it existed before, but it really wasn't until about, I think, 1996 or so did it really start to come out. And then we saw the exponential growth. I mean, I was using it back at university, but it was in a very, very different format well before that.
And I had an AOL dial-up.
Yeah, hopefully you still don't have that.
No. 1996 is the year. I had an AOL dial-up in 1996. I think I was one of the early sort of users of the internet. What was the internet then? But sorry, go on, Brooke.
Yeah, no. So the excitement around the time with the internet is going to take over the world, and it has. It's changed the way we operate, do business. I mean, we can't imagine not living with it and all that sort. But, you know, and all these things were coming out. Interest rates were rising and people were saying, doesn't matter. In technology, for the technology sector, it's a special case because of the strong growth on a go-forward basis. Rising interest rates don't matter. But the catalyst that came along for that, really for it to change the narrative, it usually comes from within the industry of some sort. And so if we go back to that cycle, I remember, you know, we had Nortel and Cisco. And we used to call Cisco 1 cent Cisco because when they used to release the earnings, they always beat by 1 cent. Mm-hmm. And they were well-managed expectations. That's what they did. And so everybody go, great, here we go. We're on our way again. And then things changed. How did they change and why? Because Cisco came out one day on the earnings and went, oh, actually, we're pulling back our guidance a bit. And went, what? Hmm. 1 cent Cisco's pulling back our guidance? And that was the narrative flip that took place. And, you know, then when the market started to stumble. So we haven't seen that and yet it take place. We've seen the market react to some of the earnings a little bit, but like... we saw NVIDIA's actually performing a market here, so it hasn't been going gangbusters.
Right.
You know, we saw Broadcom come out with earnings last week and beat their expectations on earnings, slightly beat on revenue, but they pulled back the guidance a bit and they got hit. So we're seeing this take place. So this doesn't mean that the market's going to fall apart. Now, NVIDIA came out and all of a sudden pulled back their whole forward guidance. And actually, the things aren't going well. The market would flip on a dime probably as far as that goes. But you're right. I mean, there are other opportunities out there as well. If you take a look at the utility sector, we've seen the utility sector change because its attachment to the whole nuclear sector as well, because obviously in the States, the utility sector in the States is very different than the utility sector in Canada. In the States, it's much more electricity-based. And so it tends to react differently. And we saw the beta for the utility sector actually increase and track a lot with what was happening. The beta has gone up with that sector. And also, it's also trading with AI a little bit. But it's pulled back as interest rates have moved higher. But it's the sector you have to take a look at on a go-forward basis. And there are concerns on a go-forward basis with the establishment of data centers, because now the big narrative is these data centers, a lot of them just aren't getting built or approved because a lot of communities are fighting back. And as you say, because of the water resources. If you're a community, why in the world would you approve this? Because it takes your water. And, you know, huge amounts of water, and it is boosts up your electricity prices. And, oh, so what do you get in return? You get a few employees. Not a lot. It's not like, you know, you're manufacturing cars or anything. I mean, you know, you're talking about jobs that may largely be replaced with robots in the future anyhow. So, like, you're not getting anything in return. And everybody's starting to do that math. So I think, and sure, they've all come up with, the major companies have come up with solutions on a go-forward basis for the longer term. Like, you know, you've seen Microsoft come along and say, hey, we're going to do a PPA, purchase power agreement, for the Three Mile Island nuclear facilities, you know, for the next 20 years. And we've seen Meta go into similar contracts, et cetera. But that's longer term. That's not now. And they need it now. And even, you know, introducing gas, natural gas, you know, as a short-term solution for this is a huge issue. There's not enough turbines. Like, there's all these bottlenecks to get there. And the fragility with this is that, you know, everybody's looking at the future and saying AI is going to change the world. It is. Look, I use AI. I believe in it. I've got a number of AI programs I use, including Claude. I lean heavily on Claude. And, you know, I'm still at the beginning stages of it, but it's fantastic. And but what happens is there's something called the Gartner cycle. I thought I made this up, but then I realized I went back and took a look and said, yeah, I know. I was talking about it without knowing somebody else had come up with it. But, and basically what it says is we overestimate in the short term and new technology development and underestimate in the long term. And that's exactly what happened with the internet. And I think right now that's taking place because it, as you said earlier, things don't move in a straight line. You know, the world is absolutely going to change because of AI. But things, you know, there's a lot of overestimation here. We're seeing companies actually pull back their AI spending. Some major companies are saying, whoa, you know, the amount of tokens we're going through and the cost benefit, we're not sure about this. They've just opened their pocketbooks and said, go out and spend. That's what they said. And then we're going to figure out as we go. And now they're starting to figure out that they're not getting the benefit right back at this time. That may change in a couple of years' time. But right now they're going, you know what? Right now we're spending an awful lot of money on AI and we're not really receiving the benefit back. So we might actually see token prices actually go down in the shorter term and maybe longer term as well as about new technologies, et cetera. So my message on that is, you know, there may be a lot of overexcitement despite the incredible opportunities in the future right now. And we may see some sort of reallocation down the road. And what's the catalyst for this? I think, you know, we sort of have to maybe get through the IPOs here. I mean, you know, I don't know what the IPOs are going to do. If they're well received in the market, that could give the whole technology sector some more breathing room on a go-forward basis. And we could see the market still continue to rally strongly for a bit. And, you know, right now we're in the day of the launch of the SpaceX IPO. And, you know, it's being well received, at least pre-market here. But, you know, if we see some struggle with the other ones, well, that would be a bad sign. But I think it's really, the market's going to reassess after these IPOs get launched.
Yeah. I mean, the other ones are, the timing of the other ones is something that's being talked about. You know, if the other IPOs are coming out in the August, September period, you know, that's hard to, that's sort of hard to see right now. You know, where will the market be 2 months from now? What will the sentiment be? What will have, you know, changed between now and then?
Yeah, the danger there is that, so let's say the SpaceX IPO gets, you know, does well here for a little bit and starts to stumble because, so, you know, 4.2% of the float is being released through the IPO, right? So it's not, it's not, a lot of investors think, oh, it's the IPO, though it's the whole float. It's not. It's being held by insiders and institutions that have bought into before. So very small. It's sort of like going to the Apple store when they launched products before. They release limited numbers and drive up the excitement and you get that squeeze higher. And that's really what's looks like it's going to be taking place. But if we see the IPO stumble, like let's say, you know, we do come up with the other ones in July, late July or August. If we see SpaceX start to stumble before that, that could put a different narrative on those two other launches. And that's why they're all trying to get out of the gate and really trying to be as soon as possible on this. And SpaceX has just done this. But don't forget that it looks like 20% of the float can be, is unlocked into the market for sale in late July. So 2 days, I think it is, after their earnings when they come out or whenever that is. So it might be late July, it might be in August. I'm not sure when the earnings are coming out. So what I'm saying is it's not that far away, that 20%. And if the IPO is up over 30% from its, the stock's trading above 30% of its IPO launch, then an additional 10% can be unlocked. So there, 4%, 4.2% is being released, but there's an overhang here. And you might see that downward pressure at that time where companies are saying, great, you know what, we've done 10X or 20X on our pre-market, or, you know, we've been holding this for years. Let's take half our position out. So that it's going to be interesting to see how the market handles that. That's going to be the big test, I think, in this for sure.
Yeah. Now, Brooke, you called the late June to July 18th window the jewel in the unfavorable seasonal period. It's a reliably strong stretch, even inside a historically weak summer. Given that the market is already overbought heading into that window, does a melt-up going in actually diminish the seasonal tailwind, or does seasonality operate somewhat independently of starting conditions?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty good point, because the ideal would be to see the market correct before that period and then start to turn higher, and then the momentum carries it forward. That's the ideal scenario. But the fact that the market's actually gone up pre that period, it doesn't take away from the strength of that seasonal period at all. And it can still work extremely well. Because, so why does that seasonal trend exist? And that really comes down to behavior. It's really about human behavior. We call it seasonality, but it's really taking advantage of human behavior. And it tends to happen at the same time of the year for the same reason. So we call it seasonality. So there's a very strong trend for the market to perform well from late June into mid-July. And the reason for that is the earnings. The Q2 earnings tend to be launched starting in mid-July. Right. And investors tend to front run that, and they tend to take positions in the market to benefit from that. And that's just the way that they tend to operate. So, and that happens in all four earnings months, January, April, July, and October. So that's a strong seasonal trend. So this is, it worked last year, it worked the year before, and it worked the year before. So we've seen this trend actually do quite well. But the difficulty with that is that you have to be very careful, because moving in, as I said earlier, to the two weakest contiguous months of the year, which would be August and September on a seasonal basis. So the backdrop to that is, you know, you can't say, well, the market's doing really, really well this time. You just have to be careful on that. So I think it's a very viable seasonal opportunity, regardless of whether the S&P 500 has performed well leading into it or not. But there still has to be caution at the end of it.
As we lead into August.
Yes, correct.
Right. Now, the FOMO cycle you described in May, which appears to be alive and well, driven by call volume explosion, M2 money expansion, and gamma squeezes, you noted it typically doesn't break on weak economic data. It breaks on sector-specific catalysts, like Cisco in 2000. As we move into the second half of 2026, what would you be watching for as the potential circuit breaker for the semiconductor trade specifically, and how does the seasonal calendar frame the risk window?
Yeah, so if we're looking at specifically the semiconductor sector on a weak seasonal period, yeah, that is the sector that tends not to do well in August and September. And that has a lot of seasonal trend behind that. Due to the flows typically of semiconductors and the production, et cetera. So I would definitely be watching that sector as far as the strength goes. We've seen some very strong performance in that sector and surprised everybody. But, you know, I'd be taking a look at different markets. For instance, you know, South Korea has been like a rocket ship. It's been a little bit like a meme.
That DRAM ETF.
Yeah, just incredible. And that's because two of the largest companies are semiconductors and they're heavily weighted in the index. But I've always tracked the South Korean market because it is a good indicator as well. And I'm looking for, you know, companies coming out and from that perspective and saying, you know what, something's happening here as far as a catalyst for that to take place. And maybe it is weaker sales. You know, maybe it's falling DRAM prices, you know, might be the first indication or something like that. Well, all of a sudden it's like, there's a little bit of a pullback here from that. And those are the soft comments I'd be looking at from companies. And that would be typically around earnings. So if you take a look coming up to the next earnings cycle starting in July, you know, NVIDIA typically reports later than the other technology companies, and it tends to be about the third week in the second month for the earnings season. So that would be in mid to late August. And maybe if they came out.
It just coincides with that timing, right? I mean,
it does, you know, and maybe we have some IPOs at the same time. So at the same time, but you know, if they came out and said, hey, you know what, things aren't as good as what we expect. Now, interestingly enough, the CEO of NVIDIA two earnings releases ago, basically said, can you imagine if we came out with weaker than expected earnings, what would have happened to the S&P 500? That was his comment. And I thought, that was an interesting comment to make. Yeah. In other words, he's trying to be, I question whether there's being bias coming into the stuff because he feels a weight on his shoulders on this to actually come up with good earnings. And we saw this back with Cisco and Nortel,
right,
back in that whole earnings thing. And you take a look at Nortel, and there was lawsuits coming out after because, hey, you didn't tell us, you didn't reveal the earnings as well, you know, guidance you should have been changing, but you were always so positive. So that's a big risk to the market. If one of these super behemoths come along in the sector and start to go, you know what, this is actually weaker. Because the expectations are moving higher and higher. Like if you take a look at some of the earnings releases.
It's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure on the CEOs,
Yeah, and I find it's the retail sector and is typically driving this market. And I find it very interesting because a lot of it, you know, is definitely algorithms and hedge funds, you know, trading the market. But there's a lot of retail also that are doing this. And you look at retail versus institution positioning, the retail has actually had a large impact and caught some of these rallies here. You mentioned earlier gamma squeezes. So they've been part of that phenomenon taking place where they're doing short-dated call options out of the money and driving the market higher. And, you know, so the dynamic about what could change for the market to move lower could also come from that side as well. If the retail starts to get retail investors start to get a little skittish.
Well, and you couple that with what you brought up earlier, Brooke, which was about, you know, the potential bottlenecks that might come as a result of the squeeze in production in helium and tungsten, right? Neon. There's so many commodities there that are associated with chip manufacture, you know, with chip fabrication. We're seeing that risk has not resolved. It's widened. And if you couple, you know, the Strait of Hormuz blockade, a supply constraints or supply shock that you mentioned earlier in this conversation, that could lead to a recession in sales. Right, that could lead to companies having to issue guidance that, you know, we have to halt production or we have to slow down our production because we're short on these commodities.
Yeah, let's go back to COVID for a second. You know, the expectations from people is that, you know, we saw some supply chain shocks taking place, and everybody just thinks it's just natural. You know, that oh, it's over. We flick a switch and we're back to normal. And
yeah.
You know, how long was it before car production, you know, got the right chips in to control whatever was in the car? I mean, it wasn't when COVID ended. It was like, you know, a couple of years after. I mean, some companies were still selling cars without the chips and putting the chips in after, like all this stuff. And it's unbelievable how the supply chain logistics, how long it takes to heal. And it's not a flick of a switch. And, you know, if we do run into these issues and we keep drawing down inventories, whether it's oil, whether it's some of the other commodities we're talking about, we're drawing them down. But if we start to really run into some of those bottlenecks, it takes some time to heal, basically, to fix that system. And it's just the perception out there that, you know, right now it's just not of concern. So I do think that that's a risk that it's not fully priced into the market. I mean, the market price is in everything, but sometimes you look at it and go, and I'm not trying to be bearish here or whatever. I'm just saying this is something I take a look at and go, I don't understand because of the binary situation. If you can't make semiconductor chips at some point, then you're in trouble. I mean, what they'll do is they'll start running out of the commodities, you know, whether it's, you know, helium or WF6 or whatever it is. To make some of these products, and then they'll start to redirect it into the more important ones. And this is what we saw with the rare earth elements. I mean, you know, do you want rare earth element? You can make some batteries for consumer consumption. Or are you going to use that in your F-35 fighter jet or something? Like you're gonna redirect it. And so that gives them a little bit longer time for that to take place. But, you know, it just takes the gas in the tank down further and further. And I don't know what the critical dates are. I'm not an analyst that goes in and takes a look and says, what are the inventory levels and where's the flow? But, you know, we do have some things I'm taking a look at and going, maybe there is some more life here. But we've also seen this with the commodities as well. Like right now, we have a shortage in uranium, right? You know,
shortage. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and we all know the demand curve going out into the future is just absolutely huge. I mean, it's just a matter of whether it's really big or really, really big. And we know the supply curve doesn't match. So mathematically, and you know, a lot of investors say, well, why isn't uranium going up? Well, it's the same factors we've talked about. Just nobody cares at this point. And silver, you know, we've had a silver shortage for the last 5 years. And to my point, they've been able to get silver from different areas to make up for that shortage. But at some point, that becomes a big, big issue, especially if you keep finding new ways to use silver, and which they keep doing, by the way. And I saw this really fascinating article last year where Samsung has created a solid-state battery, a prototype, and it requires 1 kilogram of silver for an average battery for an average car, which is a lot.
That is a lot of silver. Yeah.
But you say, oh, okay, well, that means that's at 10 years. No. They're actually looking to prototype this in 2027 in a small way and really start mass marketing in 2030. So if you start taking a look at all the EV cars, if it does go this route, the demand for silver will just be absolutely huge. So what does Samsung do? They're actually taking they purchase a takeoff agreement with a small silver mine in Mexico. Why is Samsung doing this? Why are they doing this?
That same trend is happening in the uranium sector as well, where companies are going straight into the supply chain and making investments directly, as you know, getting involved directly in the supply chain and taking stakes because they want to get ahead of it.
I think we're going to see more and more of this. This is going to, like, you know, you've seen the U.S. actually takes stakes in some of the lithium companies in the States, you know, and other companies as well. But even aside from that, I think we're going to start to see governments and companies who need a product, a commodity, as they become tighter and tighter and tighter. And we're seeing lockdowns take place for commodities or setting up gates for this. And companies are going to start saying, well, how do we guarantee our supply? Because we don't want to be able to see it stop our production just because we don't have enough of a product. Like, you know, we saw earlier in this year, we saw silver, China come out and set up the mechanisms to gate silver export, finished silver. Now, they haven't really done it. They've done it other commodities, and they keep doing it, by the way. They keep on restricting commodity exports, and it's a problem for the U.S., but they've set up these processes to do this because, you know, you see a lot of, it's a net exporter, obviously, and it's a huge, that's where a lot of the silver gets refined. So they import a lot, refine it, and export it back out. But this is problematic, but it's not just silver. And so companies are going to go and say, well, how do we actually do this? And I wouldn't be surprised to see some companies go say, you know what, we're going to buy a silver right from a mine, or we're going to buy copper from a mine. There's another shortage developing as well. And that's copper. The shortages. Right now, we're not in a shortage for copper, but we talked earlier about the data centers.
Once that data center build-out starts, yeah.
Yeah, and the EVs as well, et cetera, et cetera. So all that sort of stuff, it's going to be absolutely huge. And we're just going to see the deficit in copper. The shortages just grow out into 2040 at a rapid pace. And that's expected to start very shortly as well. So once again, I think we're going to see more buying from companies as well in that is happening. So let's just go back just for a second. I'm not trying to take away from the technology sector side of things and say, no, that's not a great place to be. And it's only commodities at this time, or the market, take a bearish position on the market. You know, the focus really is about seasonality and saying, when do these sectors do well at different times? And, you know, we technology can still represent an excellent opportunity. We're just looking for inflection points for money flows to be moving into other sectors of the market and what that is telling us about the market. Longer term, I think there's a bigger cycle here and a bigger opportunity in some of the commodity spaces as well.
So, Brooke, gold, Canadian banks, and healthcare, all three came up in both of your letters, your recent letters, as sectors sitting at seasonal inflection points. If you had to identify the one sector rotation that advisors are most likely underestimating over the next 6 to 12 months, based purely on what the seasonal patterns are telling you right now, what would it be and what's the setup?
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about gold to begin with. I can talk about the Canadian banks, why they've done so well, and healthcare if you want as well. But gold, so we saw gold do extremely well in 2025, as everybody knows, do really well to the beginning of 2026 in January. And there was a lot of media hype, really, about this. And a lot of that was driven by central banks, which are continuing to buy on, at right. this time. We've seen some sort of some liquidation from Turkey. They've sold 60 tons because they had to, because they need to protect their currency. And that's been part of the drawdown that we've seen with gold taking place over the last couple of months. But interestingly enough, the North American investors really weren't participating in that rally. They were not the primary cause of gold moving higher at all. It just wasn't, they weren't on the board. And how you can track that is, but if you take a look at the number of ounces, the inventory of gold ounces in the ETF, GLD, so the Spider gold right. ETF, and that's the big one. And you go back and take a look and say, how many ounces of gold does it have? And you plot that out. And I've used this graph several times. Really, the number of ounces in 2020, we saw that increase going to 2020. But then we've seen it actually go down. So as price was rising, North American investors were selling their gold. And it was only over the last little bit, 2025, do we start to see that actually start to increase a bit. We're still below that peak, by the way. Yeah. And so it's been other factors. And so we've seen that pullback with gold because a lot of it's been, we've seen that what we call the investment tourists who come in for the hot money. They're there while the trend is there and try to take advantage of what's taking place. And that's partly what's happening in the technology sector as well. There's a lot of the tourists are in there just for the trade. They don't care about the long-term prospects of SpaceX or whatever it is. And so we saw that with gold and silver. Everybody said, okay, I'm going to go in there because it's going up. I don't care about anything else. And that's why they're buying it. And that's actually flipped the other way as we've seen some negative pressures on gold. So we've seen that pullback for gold into this level. I want to say that the next strong seasonal period for gold starts in July. And the way I always look at it is, can you actually go in earlier and sometimes later as well, and using technicals to help to make that decision? And if it becomes oversold within that window, about 6 weeks out or so, then that can actually be a good buying opportunity. Well, we're actually just entered into that 6 week window and we've seen gold become extremely oversold. And part of that's because the tourists have been leaving. The long-term commitment of investors that have been holding course are probably still there, but it's been more the momentum players that have left. Have they all gone? I can't say. But we're yeah. probably at this point, I think, such an oversold position. You know, according to the way I measure it, it's actually looking to a good early entry opportunity for gold to perform well into September here, and we could see that develop. Now, if we see the market trade much lower here, that maybe we do see a pullback because of the beta. We're seeing some positive correlation between the two. But if you had to ask me about it, out of the three, I would say that gold right now represents a very attractive opportunity based on how much it's pulled back at this time and become so oversold just before the start of this strong seasonal period.
That's interesting. If you consider the sentiment, you know, a lot of people are disappointed that gold didn't rally at the outset of the Iran conflict.
So gold trades off of a number of different variables at different times. It's not an easy metal as far as that goes. Here's the only thing it trades off of. And I really believe there's a misconception out there in the way gold trades off of geopolitical risk. And, you know, a long time ago, that used to be the concern. But so why does gold trade off when there's geopolitical risk? The reason why, like a long time ago, that it did well on that is because the concern was not so much the war. It's because this concern was that countries were going to have to print money and debase their currencies to finance the war. That was the reason for gold to perform well on a geopolitical risk time. And there'd be other factors for small countries where you go, okay, you know, it's now that's a, that currency is going to fail, but the US dollar is not going to fail, as an example. And that's really the benchmark with gold here. So it's not geopolitical risk. It really is about currency debasement.
Right.
And, you know, as far as printing money and M2 and other factors such as real interest rates that that do this. And so the narrative, you're right. You know, everybody go, well, it didn't go up when geopolitical tension increased. That's because if you take a look forward, everybody's going, oh, there's going to be peace and we're not going to have to see large money printing. You know, so that's really what happened. And we have, on the other hand, and we have a choice. We can go into AI where the returns are at this time. And just given the expectations about the settlement of the positive settlement about the war eventually, and we have this hot money going, we'll go into AI. And you're right, it'll provide some reluctance, and we have seen gold work its way down lower in it, as well. So the narrative is going to be hard to really flip as far as that goes. And in the short term too, I will say the one thing is that if we see inflation going up, and we saw the inflation numbers come in a little bit higher than expected on CPI this week for the US, and they're only so high in Canada this time. So they're all well above target. And the concern is that they're going to keep going up. That's the big concern. In the short term, the concern as far as valuation for gold is that that means the Federal Reserve is going to have to raise its interest rate because inflation is going up. And they're going to have to hike, which would lower the opportunity cost for gold. And so therefore, it can have a negative pressure on gold. But longer term, you go, well, higher inflation means they're going to have to print at some point, you know, they raise interest rates, or this will be a temporary phenomenon, but they're going to have to do something later on. So there's some short-term imbalances as well. But, you know, I'll take a look at it from a seasonal perspective and what the price action for gold is. And it's the unknown here is Warsh, right? So here we have him coming out next week, his first step up to the podium, and we'll find out what's going on, you know, how he manages this whole process with Trump and his expectations. And he's trying to say that he has different measurements for CPI. He wants to use a trim measure, which Canada uses, versus headline measure and year over year. So there's a lot of unknowns here with that as well.
Yeah.
Maybe he does come out a little bit hawkish in the beginning, you know, to earn some credibility on the stage and then start to back off of that. I think the U.S. is going to have to, you know, watch it as far as the hiking of rates longer term and really trying to take liquidity out of the market. Now, what's a lot of people don't know, the Fed's actually doing a QE program. They don't call it QE. They've been doing it since December. They call it some sort of reserve management or something. I don't care what you call it. You're expanding your balance sheet by $40 billion a month. It's QE, right? And the M2 is going up. So there's other factors there as well. But so, you know, gold, it'll be interesting to see how gold transitions with this. But longer term, I really believe the Federal Reserve will have no choice but to be coming out and being supportive just because interest rates will be moving higher. The economy, you know, looks like it could be slowing down, et cetera. So, and that's really the longer term phenomenon for gold rather than geopolitical risk. The investors shouldn't get caught up in the geopolitical risk. It's more about currency debasement and, you know, what's expected longer term.
Yeah, I'm certainly, you know, I don't think anybody's really, you know, considering the setup for stagflation. It is making rounds. People are talking about it, but nobody wants to actually acknowledge that it's something that could actually come to pass when you have an economic slowdown coupled with inflation. You know, that's not a good outcome. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Warsh does, because, you know, he's still got to go up against the entire committee as well. And so what he says publicly and what happens behind closed doors will be interesting. You know,
even behind closed doors for their meeting, that's all choreographed.
Yeah.
So the closed doors are before the closed door, which is leading up to the meeting. They've agreed to say stuff already at the meeting, and they get together for a public show as well. But Yeah.
But they, you know, the Fed presidents and Fed, you know, the Fed governors, they often appear, you know, on solo interviews and talk about what's going on sometimes behind the scenes. They're not, you know, that forthcoming, but they do transmit their dissension.
With that, I always, it's like a little bit of a show. So the Fed comes out of this meeting. And so right now, this week, you won't find any of the Fed players actually doing any presentations. So this is their quiet period. They're not allowed to talk. And then they come up with a meeting. And then the next week after that, they all go back out into the market. And that's job owning to control the message. So if the market, you know, takes it one way too much and they go, oh, the market misinterpreted really what we were trying to do here.
Yeah.
And then they come back and they do counterpoints to try and bring that back into balance. It's a balancing mechanism that they do all the time. It's a very busy speaking schedule where they're trying to control the narrative after, so the market interprets what they're trying to do as they want them to interpret it.
Well, I remember, you know, Alan Greenspan's briefcase.
Yeah.
Right. That was the signal, right? That was when you know, the Fed was largely, you know, a black box as far as what they were going to do until they actually announced.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember those days too. I mean, you know, in those days, we didn't know who the Fed governors were, right? Now We plot them, who's hawkish, who's not, who's leaving, who's voting. And then we get all caught up in that. And sometimes I wonder if it's a little bit of a distraction about really how things really work in the end. And you know, but we're just focused on this. It's quite incredible, the change from, you know, yesteryear.
Well, it's almost as though, like, the idea is to not be secretive, but to cause confusion by having so many mixed narratives that you can't actually come to a consensus on what they might actually do.
Okay, somebody else does that as well. And I don't want to name names here, but a leader of a country.
Brooke, any thoughts that you want to share on Canadian banks or healthcare?
Yeah, so Canadian banks, I mean, they've done extremely well. And you have to ask why they've done really well. And I've seen this before, you know, just going back into, you know, the 1990s, we saw, you know, when they had Asian contagion, it was the opposite. And so we saw a lot of the resource countries, their stock markets get sold off. And that included Canada. You know, so that was back in the late 1990s, and the Canadian banks went down. And everybody says, why? Why would the Canadian banks go down? It's because foreigners didn't care. They go, Canada is a resource country. We got money invested in the banks, et cetera. We're going to just take our money out. We'll shoot and ask questions later. We're seeing a little bit of the opposite of that. So first of all, the Canadian banks are fundamentally different than the U.S. banks. They have different businesses. It's very interesting that the Canadian banks have done so well and the U.S. banks have done so poorly. Like, really bad,
right?
People, the gap is just absolutely incredible. And I think what's the attractiveness for Canadian banks has been that they're an oligopoly. You know, they did get through the great financial crisis much, much, much better than the U.S. banks. So, they, you know, in international investors look at it differently than we do. And they pay a high dividend. And we're also seeing, from around the world, really starting last year, we're seeing countries go, we're not sure about the States. It's a little bit, you know, as far as, I don't want to be political here, but they're saying from a predictability standpoint about which way things are going to go. And maybe we shouldn't have so much money in the States as far as investments go. And so let's invest in Canada, you know, resource-based country, especially if we're going to be going to commodities. And one of the top ways that foreign investors will invest is Canadian banks. And so I think that's been a factor. Now, I've tried to dig into those numbers here. I really haven't seen reports that do this, but you know, that's my strong suspicion, is that that's what's taking place. But investors in general have been attracted to the sector because, and this, it's not volatile from a price standpoint. We haven't seen like the VIX spiking up and staying high or whatever. But, you know, there's investors who appreciated a lot of the attributes that the Canadian banks can provide. And the economy in Canada has been quite poor as far as growth goes. And, you know, we've had fairly weak GDP numbers for a while. But we haven't really seen concerns about, so we just entered into a technical recession.
Technical,
we can argue about whether that's a recession or a technical recession. but we haven't seen sustained economic weakness in Canada. And that's really what investors, that's when you start to really say, well, the banks could be affected by this more. And so we haven't seen that yet. And so that would be the catalyst where the Canadian banks would maybe lose a lot of their shine. I don't think that the technical recession is going to do it at this point, if you want to call it that. But the narrative is still there that Canada is doing okay. It's not doing well, but it's doing okay. My concern with Canadian banks is their very rich valuation here because of their attractiveness here, that if we do start to see weaker economic numbers come out, we could start to see some underperformance here. I think so. They released their earnings. You know, they'll be slated to release earnings in the last week of August. And that's, we can see them actually do quite well, even on a seasonal basis from that period. Usually in this period here in June into July, they tend to be a little bit weaker. They're doing okay here. So, I mean, it's just, it just carried on. But I will be watching those earnings come out and seeing the market reaction to that. But they are richly valued. I see it a little bit troublesome if we do start to see more talk of a slowdown taking place. And, you know, coming back to the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, if that continues to play out and there starts to be more ramping up of global growth slowing down and therefore, you know, coming back to Canada as well. That's definitely a factor to be watching out for.
Wow. It's great to catch up with you, Brooke. Thank you so much for, you know, for your insight and for your incredibly valuable time. It's wonderful to get your take on things. I think it's equally an exciting time in the market and all at the same time. I mean, it's everything all the time. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of excitement, and you know, it's nice to have a clarifying conversation.
We're living in crazy times, and the separation of data, you know, it's, you know, hard to take a look at with things doing well and parts of the market doing well and consumers not doing well at the lower end, et cetera. And, you know, trying to make sense of that, you know, and as well as what's happening in the stock market. It's exciting times, actually. And I do want to say that just to finish off here, that I'm not really bearish on the market. You know, we've talked about some of the tones here, but perhaps we could see some weak seasonality taking place. It's all about seasonality here, about increasing probabilities of success and, you know, positioning for that. And that's really what it comes down to. And looking at flows of money. And so there's just different sectors of the market that can do well at different times. And so there's different opportunities that come along here. But we definitely live in crazy times. I do, you know, a weekly market update video and I go, it's another crazy week this week. And it's probably going to be next week as well. But, we definitely live in crazy times.
And if people want to participate directly in a seasonal investing strategy, they can do that through HAC, through HAC, through the HAC ETF at Global X.
HAC, the ticker symbol that trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange, it's the Global X seasonal rotation fund. It's actually the oldest active equity ETF in North America. It's been running for over 16 years and has. It's done quite well on a risk-adjusted basis over that time period.
Yep.
And it uses the principles that we've been talking here a little bit, taking a look at some of the seasonal trends when probability is expected to increase, and as well making fine-tuning those decisions based upon technicals of the time.
Wonderful. Brooke, thank you so much. Thanks again. It's been great to have you, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, I've enjoyed this very much. Thank you.